Serious Rap Shit is a production of iHeartRadio.
Me and my friend take this rap shit seriously.
Back in the building, in a different building.
Yes.
This time. We are not in my living room. Serious Rap Shit Podcast. I'm John, your host.
I'm Josh, your host.
And yeah, we are rocking in the free world. How you doing, Josh?
I'm good, man. I'm living.
Yeah, yeah.
Still beautiful out. I mean, world's dying, but you know, whatever.
The global warming is so confusing. We talked about that.
Yeah.
We talked about that. You know, it's interesting to me, just like moving around the city and seeing how, you know, some folks, I saw a guy the other day with like shorts on.
Oh yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's weird. I'm like, y'all don't realize that like this shit is all, you know, we're in the end game.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It ain't supposed to be this warm and nice
in
around
February?
This time. Come on. Or whenever this episode comes out.
Yeah.
We record in February.
Yeah.
But yeah, we are back in Rec Philly, in Philly's fashion district, and we got a special guest on deck. Rapper, singer, activist, give it up for Aisha Fukushima.
Hey!
Boop, 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 boop.
Excellent! Hola, ¿qué tal? ¿Cómo estás? Genki desu ka? How y'all doing?
Hell yeah.
Good.
Chilling.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
Yes, thank you for coming. Definitely.
It's an honor and a pleasure.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, you know, we want to chat a little bit. We're going to get into some stuff with like your career and your practice as an artist. I'm really interested in the connection between the music that you make and the political side of what you do as well. This podcast is a thoroughly political podcast.
Yes, I noticed.
Yeah.
I think Phil, shout out to Phil, he calls us commies.
Yes.
Like we're like the commies podcast, but you know, whatever.
Hey, listen, man.
Yeah. You accept that? It's
I'm
all
perfectly
good.
Okay. You know, commie, like,
oh man,
yeah. I'm like Bernie. I'm like, you know, hey, listen, man. Like Castro had a really good literacy program. Like, you know what I mean? Universal healthcare. Like,
oh man, take the good, take the bad.
Yeah, you know what I mean.
Oh man,
they were political elites that they were executing and kicked out the country. I mean, you know.
It's all good. You gotta, what'd say, break a few eggs?
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Make an omelet.
It is what it is.
Did y'all see, I'm not gonna get into like election stuff, but did y'all see Chris Matthews on NBC talking about Bernie Sanders being elected?
Yeah.
And he was like, yo, I don't know if this dude is gonna start executing people in Central Park. He might. I'm like, what? You can't.
Yeah, that's really dangerous.
That's like red baiting at its worst. Yep. It's like the 50s with like McCarthy. You know what I mean? I'm like, yo, can you say that on TV?
I mean, he's been a public figure for like 40 years. I mean, he's never called for executions in Central Park before.
Right.
But I mean, you know, hey.
Oh man.
When you get to become president, you can do those type of things.
Do what you want.
Yeah, listen, Trump changed all the rules, so I guess
it might be public execution. Healthcare for all, except for the people that we execute.
Yeah, that we execute in Central Park.
That's the rule.
Yeah, it's him and Gritty. Gritty's the mass executioner. He comes out in a mask.
Swinging the
scythe. It's just big orange stomach hanging out underneath a hockey jersey.
Oh, man. Anarchy A
on
his Flyers jersey.
Yeah.
I can just see one of Bernie's staff members right now just running around now like, what do we do?
Yeah.
Change the narrative.
Oh, my God.
Like, he's never coming on that podcast now.
Right. Yeah, we got to cut all of that out.
Oh, my gosh.
We want him to come here and talk with us.
Yeah.
Oh, man. How have you been, Aisha, outside of...
That's a great
thing. I'm bad with segues.
I'm now associating you with a commie podcast that, you know, it's all for Central Park executions.
I promise. I'll cut all of that out. It'll be fine.
Actually, it would be kind of fly to do it at Love Park because there's that really big love sign and then, like, you set up the executioner thing in front of the love.
You thought this through.
I mean, you know, listen, I have a lot of spare time. I haven't been working lately. Like,
oh, man. I'm going to say, this is like, you've really mapped this out.
Yeah. I mean.
Oh, man.
You know, I'm not saying I go up to New York and grab Chris Matthews. I'm just saying.
Yeah, you better watch out.
You know what I mean?
Chris Matthews. We on you. We on your bumper. God damn it. Yeah, this. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I'm overheating from laughing, so this is great.
Oh man, it is warm in this room.
Yeah, it is warm.
It's very nice. Mm-hmm. It's I love. I'm a weirdo with audio stuff. So when I first came in here, I did like the snap to see how dead the room was acoustically. Yep. So it's this is way better than my apartment.
Yeah.
So that's cool. But yeah, how have you been, Aisha? I'm sorry.
Not at all. That's I've been really well. I just got back from Huntsville, Texas, which was really interesting.
I saw.
Working with some students out there. And I guess I've just been kind of recalibrating. I've, for the first time in the last few months or so, had time to kind of work on some new and reviewing recordings that I've been doing over the years that are leading towards a future album. So it's been both fun and a space of challenge and growth in that I'm working more and more doing my own productions and working collaboratively with other producers and learning a little bit more sound engineering and stuff like that. So it's been a fun process, but definitely like one of those times where you're reminded that it's good to grow and play and not always like just have pressure that you need to produce something a specific way, but just experiment and be in the lab. So I'm grateful.
Hell yeah. I love that feeling of creating something new, and maybe it's a little bit outside of I don't want to say outside of your skill set, but like outside of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
And kind of like stepping up into that, that's like a beautiful thing. And then, you know, you get there and you knock it out, and then you can look back like, yo, I did that. You know what I mean? That makes me, you talking about like starting to like approach your own production in a way. Royce da 5'9"'s new album, he produced the whole thing, which is amazing to me. He like learned to make beats and then produced this whole record, and it sounds incredible.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I love that thought of like, or that rather that practice of challenging yourself with something new. Yes. In your art and creativity.
Yeah, I think it's important for like when you're an artist and when you're creative, you like, you know, you can get into rigid routines and be like, well, this is how I work. And then like it, you know, it can cause staleness in everything that you do. When you're able to break out of that a little bit, it also like restokes fires in all the other creative areas once you've started to work on something new creatively. Like it really helps like, oh, that making me feel like I really want to write some more now. I want to do this. I want to do that because like I've been working on this other thing, something new to me, something that's now started a new fire.
Totally. I think part of why I even articulate that part of the process or what I've been thinking about lately is I work a lot with different schools and organizers doing kind of like more grassroots stuff and all this stuff. And I see a lot of pressure to perform and to always like, I mean, even if you're in business or what have you, everyone has these like benchmarks and this feeling that we're a machine and we just need to do what we're best at and all this stuff. And sometimes that pressure compacts in such a way that our creativity gets buried. And I read recently by way of actually Dr. Brené Brown, which a lot of folks, I know is a buzzword for a lot of folks, but she was talking about unused creativity basically converts itself into other really intense emotions like shame and fear and anger and stuff like that. And so I was thinking, how can I, even starting with myself and like starting to embed that in the process, even before I get to the stage or meet folks, how do I embed that element of play and that element of like being, you were saying earlier, you know, being gentle with yourself too and being willing to like not always be in the box of production and performing, quote unquote, perfectly.
Yeah.
To kind of get free. Like it's a method of getting free by being able to play and be a bit spontaneous and learn along the way. So
I think that's really insightful in the sense that like for me for a long time I was working a job I really hated, didn't like and all that. It was not exercising creativity at all. And I mean it caused serious depression. It caused, you know, and it would splinter out into all other avenues of my life where I'm just like, oh, my temper's a lot shorter. And all of it's because, like, I'm not being able to express myself and do things. And when you're not doing that, like, you know, it causes a lot of, like, built-in tension in you. Yeah. And, like, if you don't know how to like exercise that and move it into other areas, it can cause serious problems.
Yeah.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. Not everybody is going to be, you know, like Picasso or mm-hmm. like a great dancer or whatever. But like you said, with that spirit of play and, you know, really curiosity mm-hmm. is important too. You know what I mean? Like just allowing for that to exist in your life is important. I'm a beat maker, you know what I mean? Like that's like my meditation, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Outside of like actually meditating, beat making is like the thing since I was a kid. Whenever I'm like really like down or I'm short, sometimes like we'll even be in the crib and like my partner, I'll be like just like tense. And my partner will be like, yo, like when was the last time you made a beat? And I'm like, shit, it's been like 2-3 weeks or so. You know what I mean? Like, I haven't. And at that whole process, since I was a kid, really, like, sitting down with records, chopping up samples, making a beat is, like, healing for me. You know what I mean? And it allows me to tap back into, like, that spirit of play. And, like, it reminds me of being a kid again. You know, it's like, essential.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, even when we was me and him were away with a couple other friends a couple weekends ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And like you would be off like on your own, like making beats.
Yeah.
And like we were like other people else, you know, some people are off doing their own thing, but like you were like in a corner working on your beats and doing shit.
Yeah.
And but you said like while we were driving up, you're like, yeah, you know, this is just meditative for me, and like this is what I'm gonna do. Yep. You know what I mean? And I'm like, but I've known you for 30 years, so it's like, all right, I know if you're in a bad mood.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
It wasn't me being like antisocial.
Exactly,
it was like,
yeah.
We're in the Poconos. We're like, it's like snowing. We're about to water. I'm going to get up, eat food, and make beats all day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it really, I haven't even really unpacked that trip and how that trip made me feel. I didn't listen to any of the music yet that I made. I just kind of got back, you know, home and just started
fell
like,
back into the routine.
Yeah, hitting the ground running. But I
still haven't unpacked from that trip.
Geez. Like,
but that's just
neither have I, in a way.
That's just me. That's just me being lazy. Like that. Right. There's no emotional. You know what I mean? The emotional unpacking, whatever. But like my clothes are literally in the same bag. I just be like, I'll get to it. Like,
yeah, just live out of the bag. It's all
that's
good.
Right.
Listen, when me and my kid's mother first split up. And I moved back in with my mom. I had just like trash bags full of clothes because, you know, whatever. Like, I just threw everything I had, threw it in a trash bag. Mm-hmm. I lived out of those trash bags for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Like, even like, would wash my clothes and just be like, oh, I'm throwing it back in the trash bag. I'm like, I was perfectly okay with that to the point where when I was going away, when I went to Puerto Rico like a couple years ago, I was talking to somebody and she was like, yo, you can't, like, I was like, well, I'm just gonna grab a trash bag and like take it to the airport. Like, I don't care. Uh-huh. I mean, like, I'm not like, it's just, I don't need anything special. Like, you know what I mean? Why do I need a bag? I'll tie it. And she was like, you cannot do that. Like, you cannot show up. But I've never,
TSA
like,
is going to arrest you so fast.
I'm not, like, at that point, I had never really been anywhere. Mm-hmm. So, like, it was the first time since I was, like, a kid actually going somewhere. Mm. And I was like, well, why? Like, what's the big deal? Like, I'm not going to spend $70 on luggage. Like, there's no reason.
That's the reality show I want to see. You trying to get into TSA with a trash bag.
I get pulled out of line all the time. Like the beard, the tattoo.
Yeah.
Like I get pulled out of line every time.
Yes. Did you, let me ask, I don't mean to go on a tangent. Did you, or am I thinking of somebody else, get stopped by TSA for having a pic?
Yeah, when I was in India. I had, they pulled me, like my bag went through security. I'm going through security. We were in Mumbai, I think.
Yes.
So I was going through the line, and took my bag, and I'm like, what's up? And they're like, hold on. And they're looking through it, and they're trying to find something. I'm like, what's going on? And they pulled it out, and they were like, what's this? And it's a big, like, you know, fist and metal spiked pick for my beard. And they're like, what is it? And I'm like, it's a pick. And they were like, what's that? And I'm like a pick for my beard. And the guy was like, oh, he laughed and he was like, hold on, tell this guy. And I'm like,
what
the hell? I'm like running a comedy routine. Like, oh, I mean, man. I could you just give me my stuff? I got another connecting
That's
flight
not
to
right.
catch.
That's not-
oh, man. I wish I was there for that. I would have been in the background, like,
definitely a wedding.
Exactly. Dude, it was like we kept getting pulled out of line because Raj had like all this DJ equipment.
Yeah.
So it's like all like, you know, it's all you know, electronic shit. So it was a issue until we were just like, fuck it, just like, we'll just let everything go on the plane. We're not, no more carry-ons. It's not worth our time.
Oh my God. That's a very real, ongoing process. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. And I always get pulled out of line. So like now, like thinking about it, like, yeah, probably like taking the trash bag to the airport would have been like, they'd have been like, why? Like you care that little about your clue. You're definitely going to blow this plane up. Like, you know what I mean?
Oh man.
Yeah, I'm not. I try my best, and then I'll be like, "Yo, everything's cool. Like my shoes is off, like way ahead of time.
Oh,
like I'm gonna be the easiest thing to get through here." And I'm still like, "Yo, can you go through that side one?"
Right.
Like,
the DJ equipment thing is the worst because they absolutely think it's a bomb.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have like I flew to New Orleans with like my Gemini mixer because I was DJing down there. And like this thing is like made out of steel. It definitely looks like a bomb.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they just yanked it out and they're like looking at it. Uh-huh. And the one guy was like, "Oh, you a DJ?" I was like, "Yeah, DJ."
Yeah, that's it, DJ.
It's all good. Don't worry about it.
Swigger. Yep, DJ. I'm a good
the universal sign for DJ. Swigger.
I feel like I could relate to those stories in a lot of different ways, carrying equipment, except people often assume that I wouldn't know how to use it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's like a gendered piece to it.
Oh, yeah,
even
definitely.
More confused. And I'm like, just microphone. Bring it on the way. I remember I toured with my band in Palestine, and we arrived, I think, at least 5 hours early for our flight. And
oh,
we
wow.
just barely made it.
Really? Wow.
To the plane. They had us at some point hopping on one foot, spinning around.
Right.
It was like, no joke.
Alphabet backwards.
Oh my gosh. Exactly. Unpacking all the gifts. Yeah. So travel. Yeah. All these elements of travel and also the privileges that come with it. I mean, you know, depending what passports we have and all that stuff, crossing different boundaries and borders, for me is always like a very awakening experience.
Yes.
And that freedom of movement that I both feel acutely aware of and yet also take for granted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like when I was flying home from India, I flew back by myself. Flew there with a couple people, but flew home by myself because other people had like their flights for the next day, whatever. Dude was really questioning me in security, like, "Well, what were you here for?" And like, "Well, I'm like, I was here to work, like, you know what I mean?" What were you doing? Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, "I mean, why? Like, I'm just going home, like, you know what I mean? Can I just fly home? Like, why are you questioning me, giving me the third degree?
Yep.
Like, my passport, everything's cool, everything looks good. Like, why is there an issue? Like, you know what I mean? But what were you doing?" And like, blah, blah, and I had nothing with me. None of the equipment came back with me. None of like the video files. Nothing was coming with me. Mm-hmm. So I'm literally just had my regular carry on bag and me, and it was like, "No, well, what were you doing there? What?" I was like,
"Wow,
why?"
Mm-hmm. What's interesting about that, like with what you said, also, Aisha, with being acutely aware, with having this freedom of movement, there are people in the world who, you know, just move about the world, and based on maybe like their gender identity or their racial background, they don't get any of this stuff that you know the three of us would get in a situation like that, you know what I mean? Which also, you know, happens in other realms of, you know, of life where they just have a privilege where they're just like kind of blind to it.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because it doesn't affect them. Maybe, you know, someone close to them might get into a situation and they'll have like a realization like, "Oh yeah, this is real." You know what I mean? But with them, you know, firsthand experience, it's like it's a breeze.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I mean you see it with like super like anti-gay like lawmakers, and then like their kid comes out as gay and they're like, "All of a sudden now I have a realization on why like persecuting gay people is wrong."
Which is like, such a crazy like that's such a
why you need that firsthand, like you know what I mean?
Right. It's such a crazy proposition. Like we all know people who are, you know, different from us in a variety of different ways. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't need to have like a kid who is XYZ or identifies as XYZ to be like, "Oh, you know, we shouldn't oppress this whole group of people based on that. You know what I mean? Like, it's that's a weird line of thinking to me, but it's accurate that that's how some people feel.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think it's big. Like, they talked about, I think it's big to have like representation in like media for simple things like these, right? Because if you watch like with the Watchmen show that was on HBO, and they covered like the Tulsa massacre and all that. Now, like in Oklahoma, it's mandatory. Now they want to make it mandatory that their kids are taught about the Tulsa massacre, and it's why like representation in media is so important because, like, whether we want to admit it or not, like, what we see is how we then, like, interpret the world. So, like, you know, as we all know, like, you know, black people were only hired to be, like, drug addicts or criminals for a long time. And, like, so...
In, like, films and stuff.
Yeah, in films. So, like, generally, that's what you're going to... Like, if you... That's what you see, and you're in a town in Iowa that has two black people, and you don't know them. Like, you know what I mean? That's what you associate, because that's what you see. That's why it's having, like, you know, gay people on TV is really important because, like, if you don't have the interactions with them, you need to see that they're just regular people like anybody else who have the same issues and same problems. Like, that stuff is really important. And, like, it's not so, like, people start seeing that kind of stuff where it's like, oh, well, like, I didn't even know about this. I lived in Tulsa my whole life and never even heard about this story.
Like people in Philly would move.
Yeah, oh, exactly.
Never heard of move. And they've lived here, you know, for however long.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that ties in some ways, like, the media representation and the her, his, they story that's told or untold. I mean, I think about people, I'm curious about why folks like Yuri Kochiyama, I'm thinking about, like, we're a lot of headlines about Malcolm X, right, in the last week, and thinking about how she was cradling him in some of the last moments of his life, and how often she gets edited out of that story as a Japanese woman who was also solidarity building, and her apartment served as a meeting place, you know, or Grace Lee Boggs in Detroit, who's been a mentor to so many young people, including, like, Complex Movement, Ill Weaver, among others. You know, Adrienne Marie Brown has a lot of these, like, books that are getting a lot of great shout-outs, and I'm just thinking, like, sometimes those stories don't get told, even though they involve coalition building and solidarity building across a lot of different identities, whether that's racialized identities or gender identities or class interests and stuff like that, that it's interesting what gets passed on and how, in my humble opinion, it seems to reinvest oftentimes, like, the hegemonic narrative around history seems to reinvest in a divide and conquer mentality.
100%. I mean, you have, like, in California, the Panthers would work with AIM and they would work with the Chicano movement. Like, none of that's not discussed or anything. Like, it's literally set up as, like, oh no, AIM was this, the Panthers were this. Like, no, they were all working toward a set goal. You know what I mean?
Global movements.
Yes, exactly.
The piece about Malcolm X made me think of years ago, Amiri Baraka was on a show. I think it was like the Gil Noble Tell It Like It Is show from back in the day. And this was in the lead up to Spike Lee making the Malcolm X film. And Amiri Baraka famously was not with it at all. He didn't want Spike Lee to do that film. Not because he had any kind of, like, hatred for Spike Lee. He felt as though politically Spike Lee wouldn't get it right. So he said, and this clip is on YouTube, you can watch it. Gil Noble asked Amiri Baraka about, like, why he has reservations about Spike doing this film. And he said, I promise you, Spike's going to focus on, you know, the stuff that happened before, you know, he converted to Islam, and he's not going to get the international scope of Malcolm's politics. Malcolm X, when he was, you know, like, active and around, he, like you said, like, helped build international coalitions with leaders in Africa, in Latin America, you know, probably would have been in Asia and in Russia if possible. You know what I mean? Like, if he hadn't, I know he was doing stuff with, like, the Socialist Party in America. So this is a person who understood that connection helps free us from oppression. And for as much as I love the Spike Lee film, Spike Lee showed Malcolm X going to Mecca, and the great revelation that he got from that was, oh, white people aren't that bad.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if you go by the film, Spike, when Malcolm X was in Africa, he had met with Kwame Nkrumah. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? He was like building with revolutionary leaders.
Yeah,
and developing a critique of capitalism and white supremacy that was international in its scope. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It wasn't just, oh, he prayed next to somebody with blue eyes and he was like, oh, okay, all men are humans. You know what I mean? Or all men are brothers or whatever. And true to Amiri Baraka's word, as much as I love the Spike Lee film, he did fumble that aspect of Malcolm's politics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which speaks to like what you were saying about what stories get told. You talked about Grace Lee Boggs and all of these folks who, across, you know, gender lines and across racial lines, build coalitions and solidarity. There's a reason why we don't get that history.
Yeah, oh, definitely. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's targeted to be that way. Like, they, yeah.
Yeah.
There's specific reasons to not have it set up that way.
Yep.
Right. Right.
You know what I mean?
I remember I used to teach in the public school district in the Bay Area.
Okay.
And I remember there was, in particular, a lot of tension among black and brown students that I think arose from just like everyday life society stuff. Then going into the culture of the school and then all these different stereotypes that then I would hear slung back and forth as jokes or ways of kind of like creating harm between one another to try to, I mean, there's always a hierarchy oftentimes when we're in school spaces. And I then I started to research black and brown shared history and Latinx, Afro-Latinx history, and then creating, just with some of the basic internet search stuff I had, like creating these posters and putting them up around the school that were basically the shared history or shared histories from all over both the U.S. but then all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And a way of building solidarity. And then immediately within that first week, the fights went down.
Ooh, wow.
I saw a dramatic change. Yeah. But then what I noticed the next week, some of the teachers started tearing them down. Not all of them, but a few of them were like, nope. And I saw some of my colleagues just and
what was the justification? Like, what?
They said, well, technically, you need to get like a stamp of approval by way of the office. So they said you need to go back and get the stamp. But even after I got the stamp, I noticed that there were different folks who would somehow it would just disappear. So I had to make extra copies. And it was just interesting to see. I think that, I mean, that's a microcosm, but to think about, in some ways, I feel like I've seen that in a few different contexts where the power of that representation, to your point, and that storytelling of shared histories and how much power that has, actually. Like, that's why, maybe why certain books and music and movies get banned.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I saw a lot of it with, you saw more of it change now with the resist movements and then like all the pipeline stuff, but like I see it a lot in like indigenous cultures where like indigenous culture here in the North America never is considered part of all the history of like Central America and South America and all those cultures, right? Mm-hmm. But we're all the same bloodline. So when we saw some of it start to change with like the pipeline stuff and then, like even to like our indigenous folks in New Zealand, like the Maori and all that kind of stuff, like it's purposely set up that we do not consider all that one bloodline, right? Mm-hmm. Like we're purposely not, you know, oh, well, they're Mexican or they're Peruvian, whatever. Like they're not the same as us up here. Like, well, our culture was different, but that doesn't, like, culture in Africa, in North Africa, is not the same as culture in South Africa, right?
Right.
Like, things are different, but it does not change the fact that it's still Africa, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's active forces that purposely try to separate, because, you know, they do it with, like, blood quantum for indigenous folks. Mm. Purposely to be like, oh, well, you know, if you're only 1/8 and you're no longer part of the tribe anymore, like, oh, you're 1/6, like, to purposely thin out the bloodline, thin out your tribe and push you further and further into erasure. Like,
real quick note, could you explain blood quantum for folks who are listening?
Okay, so blood quantum is essentially it's a tool they use to count you as part of the tribe, a tribal nation, right?
Yeah.
So it's different in each tribe, and there's no like, you know, there's no monolith, essentially.
Like a set number.
Yes, yeah, right? Yeah. So, like, but if you're, like, 1/32nd, you're no longer part of the tribe.
Right.
Or if you're, you know, you're 1/8 in some tribes, you're no longer part of the tribe. Mm-hmm. And that's all done specifically to weed out more and more, you know, then since we use, like, population numbers to then send money to, you know, for infrastructure, for education, for mm-hmm. all those things. Like, well, if there's only 100 people left in that tribe, well, we don't have to give them anything.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right, right.
You know what I mean? We can decide, like, that's not worth our time anymore.
Because mm-hmm, you don't have the numbers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Should we take a quick break?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's jump into a break, and then we're going to get back. Aisha, I want to ask if it's okay, like, some, like, autobiographical stuff, just to get people a background. You know, we kind of been riffing, but, you know, just like a background of who you are, what you do, and all of that, if that's okay. All right, we're going to be right back. Y'all ready?
Yeah.
And we're back. Aisha, for folks who may have just been tuning in, I don't know if you can do that
on Spotify. Like, I'm just gonna, you know what? I'm just going to get
jump in the middle of the
very
episode.
20 minutes into the podcast. Now, yeah. I like to keep it a mystery so I can keep guessing.
If you just ran in the room and someone else is playing this podcast, we're here with Aisha Fukushima, activist, MC, singer. I first saw you perform at the Asian Arts Initiative. It was like mm-hmm. the Asian American Hip Hop showcase. Mm-hmm. And I was frankly, like, I was, like, blown away. Like, the the energy that you created in the room, it felt like a family circle. You know what I mean? There are different types of performers. Some people, like, get on stage and, like, kick you in the face, you know, like Henry Rollins style. I really felt like you brought everybody around. I guess, like, the proverbial campfire. You know what I mean? It felt really good.
Thank you.
You know, absolutely. Wow. Could you talk a little bit about some of, like, your background, you know, where you're from, when you started doing music, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, wow. There's so many pieces there. Thank you so much, and thank you for coming through. It was really a pleasure and honor to be able to rock with that showcase that night and to meet all the amazing folks. Like, that room was special, too. There was some good energy in the room.
Absolutely.
So how do I introduce myself. I'm a vocalist, meaning I use my voice for a lot of different things, whether that's poetry or emceeing, singing, of course. It's a big part of my work and repertoire. I'm also a public speaker, mm-hmm. so I do a lot of what I like to call performance lecture keynotes, where I mix the live performance of music with storytelling and multimedia mm-hmm. slides and what have you. And I founded a global hip-hop project called Raptivism in 2009. Mm-hmm. The longer story to that is that actually that started around 2004, 2005, even when I was kind of a teenager and just growing up in my community, and I didn't necessarily have language for what I was going through or what I saw my classmates going through in terms of, like, bullying based on discrimination and all these different things. But I realized that there was some capacity with art to change it.
Yes.
So, the roots of that, of this work with Raptivism, kind of go a little bit further back in my life story. And I was born in Seattle, Washington, but I also grew up between Seattle and Yokohama, Japan. So Yokohama ni sumneimashita. And I also lived in the Bay Area for a while after that. Now I live here in Philly, which is a joy and a pleasure. Mm-hmm. And I consider myself in many ways kind of a global citizen because I've been doing this work in about 20 different countries around the world and counting. And I'm just learning along the way. Each time, even whether it's a trip across the city or a trip across the world, there's always something to learn. And I always feel like I'm traveling and trying to approach things also with a beginner's mind, even if people might identify me as an educator or whatever label they want. I think that's a big part of my pedagogy and my workflow.
Okay.
Yeah.
When I'm always curious with particularly people who are musicians who are in, like, hip hop culture.
Yes.
When did you first start making music? Like, when did you, what was it like you were a kid, and I'm assuming, like, when did you first start, like, oh, I want to rap, or I want to, you know, sing, or like, tell me about that.
You know, actually, I'm somewhat introverted, and mm-hmm. I think as a kid, I was also a bit shy at times, and the music, I think the largest influence was watching my parents, who with, I think, a couple $100s, started a booking agency. It was more of my father's dream at that time, and they've since divorced. But basically, my mother, she has a great business sense and helped manifest this vision he had of bringing incredible American artists to Japan. And okay. so thus that part, kind of in addition to my own heritage and roots and familial, you know, roots all around the world, it made a lot of sense for us to kind of shuttle between Seattle, Washington, and Yokohama and Tokyo and other kind of bigger entertainment cities because they started this booking agency. And that meant that I was, from the age of diapers until like first or second grade, grooving behind the scenes of folks like Babyface and James Brown and Funkadelic and George Clinton. George Clinton, I met later in my life again. He was like, oh, you're the baby. which was fantastic. That was really Bootsy Collins, Natalie Cole. Like, I mean, just so many incredible, great artists who had international resonance with their music. And I remember meeting Aaliyah before, I think she was still kind of like slowly surging, creating that legacy that we all, rest in power, that we all recognize today, where she was rocking those like fire person suits or whatever. It was a sports bra kind of look. And I just being like, what? This is amazing. Yes.
Oh, wow.
Wow. And so that helped influence me. I think being around those beats, even though my parents, honestly, they worked so much. They had very little, if any, time to really dedicate to teaching me to love music. Mm-hmm. But I was just kind of, I think it was osmosis.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other end of that was then me absorbing. I think before I started trying to write music, I started to make pretend contracts and learn the business side, because that's essentially what my parents, you know, that was the thing that was closest to me.
What would end up being the most important thing is knowing
business. Dang, it was a crucial thing.
Yes, it's very crucial.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So all of those things, I think, poured into that creativity that now continues to flow in my life. And then I really started writing poetry and then presenting it in middle school and high school. I kind of alluded to earlier that a lot of the, like, I grew up both performing at Langston Hughes, like a performing arts center in Seattle, Washington. And then my mom moved us to Bellevue, Washington at the time when I was quite young in secondary school and primary school. And I was one of few working class students of color in any of my schools. And that meant a lot of bullying, a lot of like intense stuff happening. And I remember channeling that through poetry for the first time, and channeling that through my little version of what I thought were like really dope raps that I would then perform in front of the class a cappella with the shaking hands and like clammy, you know, fingertips and cold sweat. And I remember speaking truth to the situations that I had experienced. Like, I had teachers telling me, like, grade my math tests differently than the other white students in my class and like fail me and give them an A. Or I had our neighbors was kind of a war of attrition, so they didn't want us to stay in that condominium as a working class family of color. So they started to slash our tires over 16 times. So I learned to bike to school. Stuff like that. And so I put that into the poetry, things that I had actually also said aloud to people's faces, like, hey, that's not fair treatment, or hey, you know.
Yeah.
And then once I put it in the poetic form, I noticed that my classmates all of a sudden opened up in a different way. My teachers opened up. There was a standing ovation. People started to ask questions. There was like a different level of connection and empathy that was not so different than when I saw crowds in Japan rocking to the same beat as all the artists that they love, that you could start a movement by way of the arts.
Yes.
So that became kind of a venue for me to think more intensely about it and then start community organizing in my teens.
Wow. Wow. Could you talk about that organizing? What kind of outside of like the connection of the music, was there anything that was happening in like a broader like macro sense in the world that made you think like, yo, I need to like get in the game with this and like and organize and bring people together?
Yeah. Well, there's so much. I think in some ways, like 9/11 is something that only processed much later in life, in a way. Like, I'm still having really strong memories of it, but I don't think I would understand how much it would make me think about the different kinds of labels that are used to relegate and separate people, and what, like, how many different narratives there are to a single story, or to any story or perceived story. I think a lot of that first organizing, though, was very much inspired by my local community and what was happening right in front of me. So I would purposely go out and listen to what my friends were going through, or observe what's happening in the hallways, and why, for example, racism was like a cool trait among all the cool kids in my school, you know, or why, like, noticing these dynamics of classism, like a lot of the students who went to my school, their parents were working in tech, even in those days, the Microsoft families, all this stuff. And so I started to see these different kinds of classes forming, even with it, like, even though none of us really were earning our own income, it was very much evident in the hallways. Yeah. So how could I use the currency of my creativity to push and change that culture and to question it critically before we go then surge out into the world, into our Harvards and Princetons or vocational school, whatever, and how can we start that conversation as soon as possible? I think that was sort of like my earliest impetus. And then later in life, I've started to kind of process things where I write songs like Flint that are about the Flint water crisis, and then intersecting that with kind of larger global issues with immigration and environmental racism and so on and so forth. So that's been a growth process.
Before we you know, headed over here to do this interview, I was watching the video where you were doing the song about Flint, and it was interesting to me. It seemed like you were connecting this idea of, like you said, environmental racism in Flint. These folks, you know, don't have clean water, and then water being this kind of metaphor for, like, life and what we need. But then it was also connected to Katrina and that whole situation. Could you talk a little bit about how you're bringing, like, these different metaphors into music? And I'm also really interested in, like, process stuff, too, if you could speak to that, too. Like, what makes you see a thing happening in the world? Or rather, I'll rephrase that. When you see a thing happening in the world that you're, like, called, like, yo, I need to speak on that, how does that become a song?
Yes. Wow. So Flint, to be very honest, my mom and I were on the phone, and she was like, someone needs to write a song about this. Why aren't you? We got to do something. And I was like, I got to listen to my mom. So I need to give credit where credit's due.
Yeah. Always got to listen to mom.
Yeah, shout out to mom. Oh, man.
So I took that as kind of like a, I don't know, a sense of direction. Definitely added some momentum to something that I was already feeling very close to, or following the news with, and feeling kind of in my gut. And that kind of turned into almost like a three paragraph essay, or like three verses that were very clear to me about these connections. Like, I immediately saw Katrina. I immediately saw Black Lives Matter movements. And I immediately saw these interconnectivity, even with some of, like, the refugee crisis panning out around the globe. But I also spent a good amount of time in places like Denmark and elsewhere in Europe, where I'm seeing these narratives that are not so unlike the narrative about immigration reform and ICE and all these things here in the States to kind of global issues. And like we were talking about earlier, I see music as a space where people can coalition build, where they can start to relate to each other's stories. So even though I'm not from Flint, I sang Flint this past weekend in Texas, and a brother from Flint came up to me. He's like, thank you for doing that. That put words to what I wanted, you know, what I was feeling. And I'm so happy that you're also sharing that narrative elsewhere so that people can feel it and be in solidarity with us. And to me, that's like, that's kind of the impetus, or that's part of the impetus for writing a song like Flint. The process, I think the human voice is so powerful. I also notice that sometimes being a woman and using my voice can be intimidating for people. And so it's a good exercise for me to play with how much space I take up and the dynamics of that. And then also to welcome people in so that we're working together and cooperatively, because I don't know how else we're going to get stuff done.
Right.
And so I bring that up because the beat for Flint is, I started producing it just with some beatbox. And ba-dum, dum, da, da-dum. I just did some loops. I do some vocal loops, right? And that, even before I knew how to like start playing with machine and other things to try to produce, that was my way of producing. And I think sometimes those vocal loops, when that can carry a beat, that can also be a really powerful force. Like a human voice can make a crowd stop. It can make a crowd cry. It can make everyone mad. You know, there's so much power that's there. So I tried to channel that almost like a wave into the flow of the song Flint. And the connection of all those things, I mean, I think my hope was to, like, all those things are related to environmental racism and different kinds of, I was struggling with the word racism because some of it I think is maybe more explicitly colonialism, also on an international level.
Absolutely.
And how much even people were seeing more, for example, environmental refugees, and that's increasing as we see more climate change.
That's only
going
to get worse, yeah. Right. Wow.
All these things. So my goal was to try to help create some of those interconnections, not just on like an intellectual, oh, that's the lyrics level, but then also kind of from a embodied place so that we can take action, because our action is embodied. It's how we move day to day. And the video was made by Jules, who was one of my students, actually one of my middle school students in San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
And then I helped manage a nonprofit for a while, some of the youth programs. And she ended up going through this youth program and became an award-winning filmmaker. And then she/they are now, you know, producing incredible works. And I asked them to work with me on this. And they created this incredible video. So I'm super grateful to kind of see that full circle, you know, literally knowing this person from being a little kid to them doing all this incredible work. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I'm interested in your organization, Raptivism. Could you talk a little bit about, you gave us a little bit of background on the origins and when it started. Could you talk a little bit about what you do through that vehicle specifically?
Yes. Thank you for asking. I like to say at the heart of Raptivism is challenging apathy with awareness, ignorance with intelligence, and oppression with expression.
Okay.
And it really started off with me as a college student. I went to school in Walla Walla, Washington.
Okay.
Very small town in eastern Washington.
Yeah, I think I've heard of it on like Looney Tunes.
I was going to say like Bugs Bunny.
Probably Bugs Bunny.
So yes, like that was an interesting space to then have this love of hip hop and then want to study that academically. And I remember I wrote my thesis about, I don't know, this song is kind of older, but Dumb It Down by Lupe Fiasco. And kind of dissecting that. So I literally spent just a year dissecting that song and going in.
Wow.
And then that kind of became a platform or a launching point where I was already kind of doing this stuff locally in my community, my hometown of Bellevue, and then in Walla Walla, Washington, of all places. And then I thought, this is actually a global movement. And part of what clued me into that was listening to the French hip hop scene. I also studied French for a long time. And so I eventually had a scholarship to study abroad to France and listened to the hip hop in France and was like, wait, there's groups like IM or NTM. And one of the songs I heard was called Né sous la même étoile, which means we're born under the same star. But yet we have all these very different outcomes, you know, in life and opportunities, all this stuff. And that was like popular. That's popular music that a lot of people, if you name that in France, a lot of people would be like, oh, yeah, that song.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that consciousness and that power of having a conversation about inequity could be so widespread and popular has always been fascinating to me. How do we get these really important messages to the people about coalition building and help inspire that work? And I think hip hop is like an incredible vehicle for that. And I realized that not only does the US have a history in that, but I think actually globally and locally, we have a lot to learn in the U.S. From movements around the world, like Senegal, where they've changed the course of two presidential elections by way of hip-hop artists.
Yeah.
Like Kurgi Crew, right? With the Yanamata movement, among others, that there's so much precedent for how we're seeing waves of change coming from hip-hop. And Raptivism at its core was really about just learning what those are and however I could helping share some of that information by way of workshops, by way of keynotes, by way of videos that we produce with Raptivism interns where I mentor young people as well in the process. Pretty much any way we can spread the word. That's hopefully that.
Absolutely. And thank you for that. That reminds me so much of I'm not like a, you know, back in my day kind of person, but I definitely grew up in that whole era of like Poor Righteous Teachers and Public Enemy and all of that stuff, like Fear of a Black Planet, It Take a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. And, you know, that idea of having a music that is radical politically, but also populist, you know what I mean? Where it's like every, like, something like Rebel Without a Pause, or even like, you know, even deeper with it, like Fight the Power. I remember the summer, I was a child, but I remember the summer that Fight the Power was like really ringing off. You know what I mean? The level of pride and, you know, like a revolutionary fervor that gave me as a young person, it never really went out. You know what I mean? Like that, whatever that fire was that they were like putting into the music that, you know, was like touching us back then, it never really, it's still there. You know what I mean? And that kind of stuff is so important because music is such a universal and like deeply resonant vehicle, you know, to touch people. If you're putting like, you know, the need for us to, you know, get out here and like tear some of this shit up and change this thing, this society that we live in, you're like, you're really doing something special if you could put it into music. And hearing you talk about that, I kept getting like an image of like Chuck D and like the Bomb Squad in my mind, you know what I mean? Because it's, you know, it's real and it's in the work that you're doing, it feels like it's in that same continuum, you know?
Absolutely. I think, actually, I first read the term raptivist in a book or a piece that Chuck D had written. And so then I met him some years later and was like, hey, is it okay if I carry this legacy forward with kind of a local hip-hop focus? And he was like, yes, you do you. And showed a lot of support and love by way of like playing the music on some of his platforms and what have you. So yeah, very much connected to the roots, and at the same time also rerouting or like looking at all the different heritages of hip-hop. Like I talked to some of my friends in Senegal, and they said, well, some people will say hip-hop started in the States, but our theory, they made an album called Boomerang, and they said it's because it started in West Africa with real storytelling, then went around the world, and then came back.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So it's like looking at these different, you know, stories around hip-hop.
Yeah, I think a lot of native, like indigenous cultures share that, like, totally. Drum beat story around the campfire or, you know, around the fire.
Yeah.
That is something that all indigenous cultures across the planet all share.
Totally. Yeah.
I heard Bambaataa say that years ago. Yeah. He was like, rapping, you know, Moses, when he was up on the mountain, he was rapping. I was like, I'm like a kid. Yeah. And I was like, oh, man, that's such a, like, fertile idea that this thing that we do.
You mean Charleston Heston was, like, dropping bars?
Charleston Heston. Not that Moses. Like the official Moses. That idea, it really like lit me up when I was a kid. I was like, oh shit, yeah. You know what I mean? This is like,
he was like, yo, I'm gonna watch The Greatest Story Ever Told with like a whole different
different perspective. Yo, I'm appreciative that you brought up Chuck D. I don't think I've ever said this on the podcast, but I write for a living. Chuck D was the first person to pay me to write.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? I might have been like 18, you know what I mean, when like PublicEnemy.com started. And yeah, the first time I got paid to do it, I was writing for like a couple of zines, like local zines, hip hop and like punk zines specifically and doing that shit for free. You know what I mean? But like the first person to send me like $300 to like to interview, you know, like rappers in my city, it was Chuck D.
That's fantastic.
How dope is that?
What?
Yeah. So anytime he comes up, I'm like, it's my guy. Not just for the money thing, but you know, all of the great like contributions that he's made. Mm. Word.
Yeah.
We should probably jump into another break.
Yeah.
We're about that time.
Yeah, let's take a break and then we'll come back. I think we should probably start wrapping up after this break. So yeah, we'll be right back. Right back in effect. Serious Rap Shit Podcast. I'm John.
Josh.
And we are here with Aisha Fukushima. But you know that because you've been listening
all the time. Because no one joins a podcast an hour in.
I've been on NPR all last week. You know what I'm saying?
So I can hear the voice.
You know what I mean?
I can hear the hello, this is John.
This is John Morrison.
Yeah, I hear that.
All songs.
I hear that.
New Music Friday.
I hear that NPR voice coming in there, bro. Like
I'm a drop like a John or a Bull or something, something real Philly and real hood on NPR.
That's why NPR would never hire me because I can't do that. Like there's no like I'm my kid's mother. Like I've had jobs call me and be like, so I'm like, all right, yeah, cool. And they're like,
it's all good.
I did it in court where they were like reading, like they're like, yo, you gotta, you know, they're asking you questions and you gotta respond with like, yes, blah, blah, blah. I was like, yeah,
all right,
yeah. And they're like,
sir,
we have to answer a verbal yes. Like, and then they were like, yo, you gotta look at the stenographer because she has to like see your face. And I'm just like, yeah, all right, no problem. Yeah. And they're just like, no, that's not
word,
okay.
Word.
Like
you have, solid.
Yeah, I'm like, I'll never end up losing that.
That's my great. I don't want it to be like contrived, but that's like my secret thing. I'll be like, how can I slip like some real like nigga shit onto NPR soon? It's gonna happen. It'll happen. Aisha,
oh my gosh.
I wanted to ask you, I saw a really dope presentation that you gave on, it's like a TED Talk that you did. They're fascinating to me. I love watching them. When I did I taught journalism this summer at the Village of Arts and Humanities, and I shout out to the Village, and I would definitely show my kids like TED Talk stuff so much to the point where one of my kids was like, is that all we gonna do is watch TED Talks?
We're like, listen, that was my dream as a kid, that the teacher would bring in a TV just to the class, like
wheel the TV on a cart.
Exactly. That was the best class. What are you talking about? You know, should be happy.
These kids nowadays appreciate
they wanna learn and stuff.
Yeah. More so than we did. But yeah, I wanted to talk about that. Like, could you talk about not only the presentation that you did, which was like really dope and like musical, and like a departure from a traditional presentation that they do with the TED Talks, but like, bring us like behind the curtain, like how that went down and like how did that happen?
So I have to be honest, I'm not sure exactly which one you're referring to because I've done four.
Oh, wow. Snap. I saw two of them. Okay.
So, but it feels a little bit like making my grandma would always say pressure makes diamonds, right? So you get a call and at some point your stomach starts sinking and there's like some sort of black hole that forms. And then that creative process, I put a lot of the energy into the creative process. And each time I've been trying to kind of pivot on different themes that I think have been central to my life, whether that's like the power of the voice, a little bit like we talked about earlier, or one of them I did was about, I called it Intersectionality Matters. Mm-hmm. And I did that kind of from the framework of being African-American and Japanese and several other cultures combined. And like we were talking a little bit earlier about language, even like eighth and a 32nd of what XYZ ethnicity or what have you. And I don't even necessarily use that language for myself, like half or quarter and all this stuff, because I think a lot of times it becomes an easy way to divide or separate things out.
I say
like
I say mixed when someone I say I'm mixed. Because it's not fair to like you know, because my mom is Austrian and she has a little bit of indigenous in her, and like it's like, well, so then I count that little like 30 seconds and then add that to the other part, then it's like that none of that, you know what I mean?
It doesn't do justice to all the dimensions that of who we be, you know?
Exactly.
I like also saying that I'm abundant. People are like, what? I'm leaving this corner of the party.
She's using words and shit. Right.
But please, I hope I'm I don't want to, I could go off.
No.
Pathways. But I think a lot of it just connects back to then that voice. And the common pulse is finding patterns of how we get free by way of both storytelling, music, and there are kind of somatic elements to each presentation. So when we met at the Asian Arts Initiative, I got folks to take deep breaths to start off, literally kind of creating a cipher in the room and recentering in mindfulness as a means for us to sink into the present moment together.
Okay. 'Cause
oftentimes, what I notice is that those snap judgments, those times when we get really angry with someone and, you know, the road rage or whatever, oftentimes we're not really actually present in our bodies and in ourselves.
Nah, we're thinking about all the other shit that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I see, like, that's kind of where my mind and my energy has been at in research recently, has been really focusing on what are the somatic, what are the embodied elements to get us to be present in the space together so that we can make change together and reduce the unnecessary, like let go of that which is not serving us, and to live in a place that's centered in abundance, not scarcity, because that scarcity inspires so much fear, inspires so much interpersonal tension and societal stuff where we're having arguments over stuff that's probably not even in our own self-interest, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that's a common thread in a lot of those TED Talks.
I think you touched on something. I don't know, did you, when Taika Waititi won the Oscar a couple weekends ago, he mentioned, he said, you know, this is for all the indigenous kids who want to paint, who want to create. He was like, who want to, you know, write stories. He said, you know, we're the original storytellers. He was like, and we can tell our stories here too.
Yes.
And when you talked about storytelling, I think that's so important. And I think it's important in the whole wraparound, as we talked earlier about representation, about all those things, like having people tell their story is what really matters. Like, because it's how other people can get any kind of intersectionality with us. Is like, if I can tell you my story, you're going to relate, like in the baseness of a story, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's, you know, a missing father, it's this, it's that. Like there's certain things that, you know, oh, like, you know, I can relate to that, like, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And it's important for like storytellers to tell their stories, because that is a place where you can, like, you can pull from, where you can go like, yeah, I can, like, I relate to that. Like, I relate to this part. So if I can relate to that part of this person who's a complete, who comes from the other side of the planet. Mm-hmm. Like, Taika Waititi comes from New Zealand. Like, you know what I mean? So if I can relate to the absentee father that's in Boy, right, then maybe there's other aspects of him that I can truly relate to, or other aspects of people from where he's from that I can relate to, because, you know, I relate to that aspect, right? So their life isn't that different than mine, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's important in having people, and especially people who are often silenced, have their stories be told and tell their stories. In fact, they tell their stories. That's very important.
Mm-hmm.
And
I would also say that it fleshes out the full picture, and you get, you know, all of the angles of perspectives. You know, I assume that other people are different. Other people have their own particular cultural things and like life, you know, experiences that I'd like celebrate. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to reduce people to like, oh yeah, you just like me. Like, nah, you're different. And me hearing you and seeing you kind of like helps me understand all of this better.
Yeah.
This being like life, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So it's dope to see, even in something as like, I don't want to reduce it, but like something like the popular cultural sphere, we're seeing, like you said, like more representation. That's just like a more rounded view.
Yes,
to me.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? I watched that show, the joint Pose.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? I never been to a ball. You know what I mean? I'm not like a trans woman living on the street, but it's like I see that and I'm like, oh, I see, you know, all of this stuff. It doesn't mean I'm like, you know, like judging your life or my, like you're like justifying your life to me. It's none of that.
No, no.
It's just like, oh, I have more of an understanding of the world.
Yeah, yeah,
because
exactly.
Y'all live in a way that I don't live. You know what I mean? So like seeing that kind of stuff. And like you said, like stories from folks from, you know, other places in the world or like other life experiences. It just makes this whole thing, to me at least, as a person who wants to understand and like values understanding, it makes me see this whole thing more clear, and I'm like appreciative of that.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Because it you know, we lived in a time where only certain people got to tell stories or
absolutely,
you know, represent or even like something as simple as like people capitalizing off of their art. You know what I mean? There's so much like great music that like black folks have made in this country that, you know, they're like poor in the grave. You know what I'm saying? Sister Rosetta Tharpe created rock and roll.
Yeah.
Well,
she's buried in the cemetery around the corner from my crib.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? She ought to be, you know, in you know, I know her spirit is somewhere great, but like her body ought to be somewhere, you know, not there.
Shrine.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
exactly. You know what I mean? So I'm appreciative that we're moving into a space where, you know, there's more input from people and there's more, I don't even want to use the word diversity, but like rich variety.
Yes.
You know what I mean? That we get to hear from people.
Yeah, I think that's why it's important for things like you do, Aisha, that are empowering younger people.
That's just so important.
Yeah, because I think, you know, too many of our younger people are put into boxes, aren't allowed to be expressive or are given like these certain things. Like when we grew up, like the big thing was like, yo, maybe you get a city job.
Tough, for real.
You know what I mean? Maybe you could be like a CO or something. Like, you know what I mean? Like, look, they make good money. You know? Like the idea of like, oh, I'm going to go do like creative shit for a living. That's not like, you know, that wasn't, no one was like, yeah, that's what you should do for the rest of your life. I mean, you know, still doing this now and trying to work in creative fields now, like I still have people that I love and are close to me go like, even, you know, I love my mother, love her to death.
Shout out to moms.
But she definitely was like, you know, you could probably still do like a paratransit driving job or something like that. And it's just like,
it's like, mom, that's not in my spirit.
You know what I mean?
I don't want to do that.
And but I think, and it's not because mom doesn't, you know, want me to be happy or something like this. It's just, you know, they have had like the idea of like, yo, steadiness and like shortness is so important.
Every 2 weeks.
Get exactly.
Benefits. Yeah.
And I think it's important to have like somebody like you to like tell kids like, oh no, creativity can be like the way you live your life. And like, you're not like boxed into even one form of creativity, right? Like we're not like, oh, all you can do is be a rapper, that's all you'll ever, you know, if that's what you want to do, that's all you'll ever do. Like, no, there's a million other ways to like live your life. Like I have a son who plays football, right? So, you know, listen, sure, you want to play in the NFL, whatever. There's the like percentages of a chance of that ever happening, okay? But there's a million jobs inside of football, right? So, and you're a creative, like he loves to draw and stuff. I said, like, you know,
I never knew that.
Yeah,
he could draw.
Yeah, he so does his little sister. Like, now I can draw her ass off.
Oh, snap.
I wanted her to become a tattoo artist, partially just because that way she can, like, she can give me tattoos for free.
Yo, this whole back piece.
Exactly. But,
Dad, I'm a child.
But I'm just like, you know, there's a million jobs inside of football to do. It's not a sports to do, right?
Yep.
Right.
That you can do and, like, make a living out of. And so I'm just like, I want, like, it's important, I think, to, like, for what you're doing and, like, what other people in, like, what you're doing to, like, push creativity on people because it's how we see ourselves in the world, right?
Yeah.
So if you see yourself represented in the world, then you go, oh, I can do that then.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's really important.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and creativity, like you're saying, it can be used in so many different ways.
Exactly.
So I wouldn't necessarily want a young person or anyone listening just to be like, well, that means I have to be a singer. That means yeah. Right? But there are all these, like you're saying, all these different pathways. And I think there also isn't that business element that we talked about earlier, whatever that means. Like, I think that there's a lot that can be done when we use our creativity to think about sharing or collectively owning platforms or unionizing or working together.
Yes.
And so that's
so
part and parcel to, like, maybe that's not in the music video or that's not what you hear on a streaming song or what have you, but that's definitely part and parcel to the process of how I try to build the foundation and how I'm envisioning different platforms to create is that we need to own more of these platforms that we're also being represented on.
Oh,
that's
absolutely.
Really important.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that it's a really crucial point, and I want to kind of push that other element through.
Listen, like the idea that, you know, we have to operate through these other gatekeepers
mm-hmm.
is kind of shitty because yeah. especially like one thing you asked us, like, one thing we've learned as we've been doing yes. this kind of stuff uh-huh. earlier. One thing I've really learned in doing creative aspects and working with like our crew and stuff, the ones who hold the money to give you to be able to do yep. creative shit, they are not creative. Mm-hmm. And they have absolutely no idea what creativity is. Yeah. They just go, well, does it sell? Can we make money off of
yes.
it?
Right. Uh-huh.
They're not like, oh, that's a really dope idea. Like, that's yeah. it's going to be really cool. Who cares if it makes money? They're like,
what are the analytics?
Yes, exactly.
Right.
So I think it's
right.
really important to get into spaces where we have the ability to be like, we can green light this shit.
Yes. I can call that shot. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
We can green light that because, you know, I know what this looks like. It's going to be really dope. That's and right. I want to see it get made.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So being able to be the gatekeepers is really important.
Yes. Yes.
So I could, you know, we could do this.
Like, yes.
We could do this all night. Somebody, this is the second person that's knocked on our door.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're kicking us out of here. Josh and I have been kicked out of classier places
yeah.
than this. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, we wanted to get, if you want to, you have anything you want to plug or like your
yes.
socials that you wanted to give
absolutely.
Out, just so folks know where to find you, how to, you know, interact with you and all of that.
Thank you for asking. Mm-hmm. So my name is also my website. That's Aisha Fukushima, AISHAFUKUSHIMA.com. On Facebook, it's Global Aisha. On IG, Aisha Fukushima again. I'm on Spotify, have lots of amazing YouTube videos and talks and mm-hmm. Even kind of mini workshop clips because I do a lot of like embodied musical work to kind of create social transformation by way of the arts online on YouTube as well. So I invite folks to come check it out, to share their feedback and to spread the word because, like we're saying, if we want to collectively organize, if we want to kind of be the source of information
yeah.
and literally creating that social change cipher, then we need to be the ones to take that first step and to mm-hmm. spread the word when we feel things that are healing our souls and that are kind of taking us to the next level as a society. So,
yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Yes, thank you so
yeah,
much.
Yeah, this was so dope and fun.
Oh, yeah. It was yeah. a pleasure to be here. So thank you.
Word. I appreciate it. So, yeah, we can get out of here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to do it? You want me to do it?
I'll do the exits.
Go ahead.
This is Serious Rap Shit on all the platforms except for Facebook because Facebook's a hater. It's Serious Rap-ish there.
Because Facebook doesn't like curse words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Come on.
Okay.
They allow Nazis, but not curse words.
Come on. make it make sense.
Next episode.
Oh, nope. Don't do that.
What did that shit say?
It started playing Serious Rap Shit. Like, it started playing the podcast.
I thought it was going to play like some Nazi shit. It's like,
hey, listen.
Siri, chill out.
Yeah, Siri, yo, you wildin'. It's Serious Rap Shit and on IG and on Twitter. I'm Indie_SRS on IG and Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
You're John_Liberator on IG and Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
So other than that, we'll see you guys next week. We want to thank, again, Aisha Fukushima.
Thank you so much.
Fukushima.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
Of course.
Don't worry.
Of course.
You got it.
fumbled at the goal line. Yeah. It's all good though. Yeah. Well, I don't want to speak for you.
I legit had it in my head like, oh, I'm gonna nail this. Blah blah blah.
That's what it is. You gotta put that first mind. Yeah. You know what I mean? Exactly. But yeah, thank you so much again.
Thank you
for coming.
It's
this
an
is
absolute
so fun.
Pleasure, and it's wonderful to be in the room with your incredible friendship. So
thank you.
Thank you for sharing the space.
Thank you. Thank you. And we out.
We out. Peace.
Peace.
Serious Rapshit is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get podcasts.